Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, ready or not, a major change in criminal justice begins October 1st, and some California counties worry about a spike in crime rates.
The legislature and the governor have basically just been trying to dump every possible program they can so that they don't have to pay for them, so they can cram them down on counties with a hope and a wink that the money's going to be there.
The head of California's Department of Corrections responds to critics who say it's too much change, too fast. Plus, a new documentary from Sweden recalls the Black Panther movement of the 1960s.
It was such a powerful film to watch because it was not decorated by American slant, apology, or denial.
It's the California Report. We begin today with a seismic shift in criminal justice coming to California starting this weekend. Some are calling it a big gamble. Others say it's long overdue. Governor Jerry Brown calls it realignment, giving local governments more control over supervision and incarceration of low-level criminals and parole violators, people who now have state prisons bulging at the seams. To see how realignment might work statewide, I visited San Diego this week, a county that in many ways is a model for helping ex-offenders turn their lives around and stay out of prison. On Tuesday, county supervisors discussed the coming changes, and it had the feeling of a shotgun wedding, a new relationship no one was very happy about. Supervisor Diane Jacob described it this way.
This is, without a doubt, the most historic change of the criminal justice system that's ever happened in the history of the state of California, with very little thought coming from our state legislators or the governor.
Under realignment, parole violators and nonviolent criminals in San Diego will serve their time here in the county jail. Inmates dressed in jailhouse blues are walking down a hallway under the careful watch of armed sheriff deputies.
All right, gentlemen, step into the elevator, three rows across, facing forward.
Right now, the county has about 800 beds available in its various detention facilities, but with 4,000 additional ex-offenders on the way, that won't last long. Talking to some of the men here, I was surprised how much they knew about the new policies. Ricky Brooks has a history of selling crack cocaine and admits to a drinking problem. He's back in jail for violating parole. The 52-year-old Brooks hopes the changes help people like him.
Man, it's kind of hard, you know, it's to get back on your feet, because every time you get on your feet, you slip and go right back to the same recycle. So I hope this new change, man, will better us, you know, not to keep us bound in.
Another parole violator, Juan Torino, agrees the current system isn't working.
They just want to stick him in prison, and I mean, that's not good, you know, because there's a lot of us that really need the help and want the help. It's just we don't know how to go about it. You know, unfortunately, you know, we end up in here and we're forgotten, you know.
But the kind of help Torino and Brooks want, social services, health care, housing, it costs money. And San Diego District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis worries that under realignment, the state won't give the counties the funding they need to do it right.
And that's where the recipe for disaster comes in. It's almost like we're preparing people to fail instead of, you know, supporting them in this process.
In some ways, San Diego is the county best prepared for realignment. For the past 5 years, they've developed a coordinated network of programs to reduce recidivism, that churn of parolees in and out of prison. The lesson, says D.A. Dumanis, is that you have to work with criminals before they even leave custody, with services behind bars that help make their re-entry into society more successful.
Best practices show us that working with all the law enforcement partners, probation, the state prisons and our community providers. That's the recipe. That's what makes the change.
The San Diego-based nonprofit Second Chance is one of those key community providers, giving ex-offenders the kind of help they need to turn their lives around and make it when they get out of prison.
So everyone had a good weekend?
Yes.
Yeah. Nobody got in trouble?
No.
How many of you are on parole or probation? Show hands.
The students have just a few days until graduation. The men are wearing ties. All the students try to put their best foot forward. One of them, Vincent Calderon, was convicted of armed robbery in 1997. He paroled 3 months ago and entered the Second Chance program.
Coming from prison, you're not really exposed to speaking in front of people or being able to speak to authorities. Now it's like you can smile out here, you know, you can walk right, posture, shake someone's hand and be able to talk to them. It's like a regular citizen.
The students learn to take responsibility for their actions and their past mistakes. It's a kind of boot camp where they learn to think differently about themselves and others. 32-year-old Tiffany Billingsley is one of the few women in the group. She served time for armed bank robbery, and she's looking for a fresh start. Billingsley describes what she's learned here.
Thinking before you speak, being pleasant, enthusiasm, motivation, sell yourself, commitment, open-minded, willingness, just basic life skills that makes you more approachable when you enter the workforce.
These men and women know what they're up against: a terrible economy, a history of drugs, felony convictions, even violence. They have to overcome all that and more. Scott Silverman, the charismatic founder of Second Chance, likes the idea of giving local communities more control over crime and punishment. Still, he says it's no panacea for fixing the state's 70% recidivism rate.
If more people come back to the community that don't have a source of income and they want to eat, they want to feed their family, or they're trying to reconnect with their family, or they feel somebody owes them something, they're going to act out.
Ready or not, thousands of low-level, nonviolent offenders will soon become the responsibility of San Diego County Probation Chief Mac Jenkins. Jenkins spearheaded creation of the county's realignment plan. He's confident San Diego can build on what it's already done over the past 5 years.
We're using the lessons learned. We're using the tools to make sure that we do this in a way that helps some people who want to turn their lives around, because that gets forgotten in this. There's some of those folks who really do will have an opportunity to turn their lives around. We're going to support them.
The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation strongly endorsed realignment and the big changes that will come starting this weekend. Matthew Cate is the CDCR's secretary, and he joins us now. Secretary Cate, as you well know, there are a lot of concerns. Communities are worried that they're going to be flooded with criminals and parolees. Some say it's a disaster waiting to happen. Are there concerns misplaced, do you think?
Well, I think there is a lot of misinformation out there about realignment. Really, we're talking about community corrections, having lower-level offenders be incarcerated and supervised by communities instead of by the state. I think there's a misunderstanding that somehow on October 1st, when this is implemented, that, you know, inmates will actually be transferred from prisons to jails or will be released onto the streets, and that's not going to happen. It's all prospective, meaning only new convictions will start to serve jail terms and new releases will go to county supervision.
As you all know, one of the most outspoken critics of this has been the district attorney in Los Angeles, Steve Cooley. He describes this as early release on steroids. He says it's going to lead to a tremendous spike in the county crime rate. You know, he knows what's going on. I mean, he's not an outsider. He's very much involved in this. Is he just grandstanding, do you think?
Well, you know, he comes from a perspective of law enforcement. You know, I've worked as a deputy district attorney myself. I know the perspective is we need to prosecute and then people serve, you know, every day of their sentence. I think that it's important to note a couple of things, though. Number one, we're not going to be releasing people early from prison. Number two, there was a threat of early release in that the U.S. Supreme Court ordered us to reduce our population by 30,000 in 2 years. And so realignment actually avoids mass early release by allowing people to attrit out after they've served their sentences and just not return for parole violations and lower level crimes.
As you know, the county jails now are going to be getting a lot of these parolees and the parole violators who would have gone to state prison. And yet a lot of county jails are already full, and some of them are, many of them are under court order to cap their population. What do you say to them?
Well, keep in mind, right now in California, there are 10,000 vacant jail beds. And some of those are at capacity because the sheriff doesn't have the funding to open up those beds. You have to have personnel. You have to have administrative help to food and water, all those kinds of things. And so we'll expect that with funding from realignment from the state, the sheriffs will open up those 10,000 beds. There's another 8,000 beds that are slated for construction over the next 3 years as realignment rolls out. And then finally, I have to say, we're really hoping that local law enforcement and local government will do a better job of helping some folks turn their lives around. We might actually shrink criminality and have a less need than we have now. We have a 70% recidivism rate under the current system.
I attended the county supervisors meeting when I was in San Diego for that story that we just heard. And I want to just play a clip from one of the members of the board. This is Greg Cox describing the coming changes.
The legislature and the governor and taking the actions that they have done have basically just been trying to dump every possible program they can so that they don't have to pay for them, so they can cram them down on counties, and with a hope and a wink that the money's going to be there.
Secretary Kate, as you know, the biggest concern counties have is resources. There is money coming down from the state in this first year, but there isn't a guaranteed funding source in the future. How can you guarantee that this funding won't be on the chopping block like everything else is right now in Sacramento?
Well, I think the governor has done everything that he can possibly do to allay concerns about funding. The legislature passed not just an appropriation for this year, but a continuous appropriation, which is very rare in Sacramento. It was the Association of Counties that said, hey, give us a 9-month appropriation, and then we'll decide how to redistribute after that 9 months is over. But in truth, I think the governor and everybody would be more comfortable and will not rest until we get a constitutional amendment that guarantees funding for counties for these responsibilities. He's committed to that. He wasn't able to get bipartisan support to put that on the ballot from the legislature. And so he may have to go to the people and let the people decide on providing a guarantee for this funding.
All right. Matthew Cade is Secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Secretary Cade, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So what comes to mind when you think of Brazilian music? Samba, perhaps, or maybe bossa nova. But another style of Brazilian music, something closer to American jazz, is gaining popularity in California. It's called choro. Reese Ehrlich introduces us to some musicians who are giving choro more of a West Coast sound.
At his home in Oakland, Mike Marshall hums a melody and strums a few notes on his 1920s-era Gibson mandolin. He's best known as a bluegrass player, but he's also one of the first to popularize choro in California. It all began with a trip to Brazil in the late 1980s, where he met some choro musicians.
These musicians really took me under their wing and took me to record stores, told me which CDs to buy. Came back with a stack of CDs and a stack of sheet music and just started really digging in once I got back. I became very obsessed with the style because I'd known it, but I hadn't seen it in its element. It really got me.
Marshall explains that choro developed in Brazil in the late 1800s when black Brazilian musicians played Portuguese popular music of the time.
Choro actually started out with Europeans playing polkas. So here they were playing, you know, simple little, you know, whatever kind of polka groove it would be. And at some point, just like ragtime started in America, that two-beat groove began to transform itself with syncopation. Mm-hmm. still a um-ta, 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 ta, um-ta, right? But it's now getting funky thanks to all those Africans who brought the swing to the New World. So a typical shoro might be something like,
Over the past 10 years, shoro has developed a small but enthusiastic following in California. For example, once a month, musicians gather here at the Casa Cultura in Berkeley for shoro jam sessions. Experienced professionals mix with relative beginners to pass on the tradition.
Ready?
Give me a second.
Mateus Horn has played Cuban conga drums before, but he's new to shoro music. Other percussionists, like Amy Molinelli, sometimes critique his playing.
They offer suggestions, yeah. Mostly Amy is very helpful.
Do you have any suggestions on his playing?
keep playing.
Amy Molinelli has become a virtuoso on all manner of percussion instruments, including the Brazilian tambourine called a pandeiro.
The difference between an American tambourine is that the skin head on it is designed so that you can get different tones. So, for example, instead of just playing the jingles, which are familiar...
Molinelli is one of the founding members of the Bay Area-based Grupo Falso Baiano. They've studied traditional shoro, but just like younger musicians in Brazil, they add their own experience, including jazz elements, to the shoro tradition.
Our goal is not just trying to play the music like a Brazilian, and acknowledging who we are, that we're going to add our accent and put it out there as strongly as we can. And, you know, especially Zach and Brian met each other at Berklee School of Music and have a jazz background, and we all have varying musical backgrounds.
For example, they take a traditional shoro and add piano, something not often done in Brazil. Falso Baiano is one of four professional shoro groups playing around the Bay Area. Some perform strictly traditional shoro, while others hope to give the music a California twist. For the California Report, I'm Reese Erlin.
For more about the shoro scene in California, check out the links at our website, californiareport.org. Names like Angela Davis and Eldridge Cleaver long ago receded into the history books. 40 years ago, they and other Californians were leading the Black Power movement from the streets of Oakland. Some of the most compelling moments from that era are captured in the new documentary titled The Black Power Mixtape, 1967 to 1975. It uses a treasure trove of interviews to chronicle the movement through the eyes of Swedish television reporters. Deirdre Kennedy has the story.
In the first scene of the film Black Power Mixtape, a Swedish reporter asked a 50-year-old white man what he thinks are the conditions for an ordinary American working man and whether America is a land of equal opportunity.
It is. If a man has a little ambition, if he's not lazy, he can always make a living. He's better off than any part of the world. At least if you don't like your president, you can tell him where to go without being afraid of being put against the wall and shot or being punished. You have freedom of speech.
The interviews and scenes that follow challenge every one of those ideas. Swedish TV reports show black Americans living in broken-down neighborhoods, children without food or proper clothing, and young soldiers back from Vietnam who can't find work.
You know, when a man goes to fight for his country and then come back over here and have to almost fight for his life, you know, in certain parts of the country, get ridiculed and, you know, and discriminated, you know, and be less than a man.
To Swedish viewers whose government guaranteed them education, housing, and health care, such scenes were appalling.
There's no milk to put in it now. Yeah,
come on, baby. Eat some of that. Eat it. It tastes like cookies.
Against this backdrop, the film shows how the civil rights movement became radicalized. In a 1967 speech in Stockholm, Stokely Carmichael tells a rapt audience why he and other young black leaders like Malcolm X and the Black Panthers split from the pacifist approach of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. King's policy was, if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none.
Director Göran Olsson says Swedish reporters got extraordinary access to people like Carmichael and other black radicals because they were sympathetic to their views. Dr. King had received the Nobel Peace Prize in Stockholm a few years earlier and had inspired many young Swedes.
Sweden were very radical at the time. And reporters, they didn't have a problem with people like the Panthers or Angela Davis or being leftist or radicals in that sense.
What they did have a problem with was guns. Whether they were used by the police, prison guards, or in defense of the Black Panthers. In this scene from the film, Angela Davis is in jail awaiting trial. She had just lost her teaching post at UCLA. And she addresses the issue of violent revolution.
You ask me whether I approve of violence. I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
These interviews are distilled from hundreds of hours of footage that Olsson stumbled upon in the basement of Sweden's state broadcasting company. He created a narrative using voiceover commentaries by contemporary black celebrities, academics, and activists who were involved in the movement. Erica Huggins is a former member of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. She says she hopes viewers will be inspired to go out and do their own research on this difficult period of American history.
It was such a powerful film to watch because it was not decorated by American slant, apology, or denial. The footage chosen gives a sense of the reasons why we spoke up.
The documentary film Black Power Mixtape is currently playing in theaters in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other major U.S. cities. For the California Report, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
The Golden State has also inspired plenty of musicians over the years, and in our series California Songs, they tell us the backstory behind their music. Today, San Francisco-based singer and songwriter John Vanderslice. He moved west in 1997, where he found inspiration all around him.
I've easily written 50 songs about California. I mean, I think that that's just, you know, if you live in a place that's interesting and striking, it will be part of the content of your art.
We talked to Vanderslice about his song Tule Fog, that notorious winter fog in the Central Valley.
I grew up in North Florida, and I remember the first time I drove through the Tule Fog. It's a completely West Coast phenomenon. It's absolutely unique to this area. And, I mean, it's completely changes your thinking. It's very intense. You know, one of the lines in the song is, if they don't ground me somehow, I'll never come back. And I had done two tours in a row. And so I found that because I was so used to moving and so used to traveling and all the compressed images that come in through the windshield or through the airplane window, that I couldn't stop. I couldn't slow down. So I would go out driving for no reason. I really would just get in the car and drive, and it was the one thing that I found very calming. I drive all night. come back. One night I drove all the way out 580, past Tracy, Manteca, went down 99 south, and I hit this bank of Thule fog, and it was just like a whiteout on the road. And so I just felt that I had reached my limit, you know, that here I was in this like fog bank for no reason, 200 miles away from my house again for no reason other than this incredibly restless and, you know, very, maybe a very American feeling. Open the window, open the window, open the window, open the window, open the window. One problem with kind of ending up on the edge, of the other edge of the country from where you grew up is that there really isn't anywhere left to go, you know, and that's a good thing and a bad thing, I guess, in the end. It's very disruptive. That drive and that desire to constantly be leaving, to be traveling, to be discovering is destructive. I have to leave. It's hard to believe. I don't deserve more than that. My feeling about the narrator in Thule Fog is that he's a prisoner, and just driving down the 99 isn't going to solve anyone's problems. What separates me from the narrator is that I'm not a prisoner. I'm not in lockdown, let's say that. I'm on parole. Like I'm very aware of my possible downfall.
That was John Vanderslice on the inspiration for his song Thule Fog. You can find it on Green Grow the Rushes. Download it for free by clicking on the link at californiareport.org. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Paul Ancour is at the controls today. We had additional engineering from Seal Muller. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. Our California song was produced by Nick Carpenter. Our producer is Victoria Maleone. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.